Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking to Diane Paul Heller. And we're really talking about how do we hold and support ourselves on our trauma healing journey? And when we have triggers and our own reactivity, when do we go into that? When do we need to step back and to hold that? It's a really interesting interview. I'm really happy for you to see this. So let me give you a bit of Diane's background. Diane Paul Heller is an established expert in the field of adult attachment theory and models, trauma resolution, and integrative healing techniques. She's a trainer, presenter, and speaker offering workshops, teleseminars, and educational materials on trauma, attachment models, and their dynamics in childhood and adult relationships, as well as many other topics. As a senior faculty member for SETI, she teaches somatic experiencing based on Peter Levine's groundbreaking work in the US and worldwide, including Denmark, Italy, Norway, Switzerland, Israel, Germany, and Australia. Her book, Crash Course, a guidebook on how to resolve auto accident trauma, is used as a resource for healing general trauma in the US and internationally. So firstly, Diane, welcome and thank you for joining me again.
It's great to be with you. I always enjoy our conversations, Alex.
Yeah, I do too. So we were just talking before we hit record and you were saying how when we experience trauma, particularly in childhood, we'll become frozen in time. And I really liked that. That's a really neat description of what happens. I'd love you to unpack that a little bit.
Okay. One of the things that I think is really interesting is how our body's trying to protect us, how our bodies, you know, our body, our psychology, all of us is trying to manage the unmanageable when we have unresolved trauma. And I'm going to address this a little bit to childhood, but it's kind of true as an adult too. When something really terrifying happens, it could be anything from a car accident, a natural disaster, a breakup, some kind of assault, it could be anything, right, that overwhelms the nervous system, then we start to physiologically constrict, and then we sort of hold ourselves in a really tight way, and then we can get chronic tension patterns, chronic pain patterns from doing that. That's one way the body reacts. But in terms of time, it's like it stops the clock. And very often trauma gets frozen in time because at the time of trauma, we're designed to process trauma. All of us, otherwise none of us would be around. But if we're trying to process that, especially as a little one, and there's no support, there's no empathetic other, there's no person there helping us unpack it, you know, oh, I can see you're really scared, or I can see you're really feeling sad, or, you know, let me hug you while you're crying through this. That really helps us integrate at the time trauma happens, even though it's overwhelming, right? When we don't have that, and very often trauma gets frozen when we don't have enough resources around it. I kind of look at it, I have this funny metaphor of the donut, which is a very strange metaphor. But when you think about a donut, the rim, the core of the donut might be the traumatic event. The fleshy part of the yummy part of the donut would be the support that's around it. And sometimes if you have really, really good support, even though something happened that was horrible, that will mitigate trauma staying stuck. And then you can integrate it, move forward and digest it and maybe even gain some wisdom from it or some resilience from it at like post-traumatic growth as you move through. Some of us, many people walking around have not only the trauma event, the sort of the hole of the donut, but they also have nothing around it, no support around it. And that particular situation is often what we're seeing in our offices or we're seeing in our friends or our partners where things just keep repeating and maybe it keeps showing up in the relationship patterns that we'll start talk about later. But I want to talk a little bit about why that happens and why we're designed to have that happen. Because when something's super overwhelmed, especially as children, but again, it could be an adult, we tend to go amnesic too. We tend to forget, we disconnect, we dissociate. That's all to protect us from this very challenging event so that we can continue to function. We can continue to kind of manage things the best we can, but it's lurking behind the scenes. And that's why I know you're on the same page with this. It's so important to allow enough support to happen that some of these disowned memories or experiences can surface, but in a way that we can process them slowly enough and with enough support that they can integrate as we go, so to speak. And that's why I think it's so important that we include physiology along with psychology and soulfulness and all other aspects of us, our emotional selves, our cognitive selves. It's really important because the body is one of the most efficient ways to move trauma into more digestible pieces if we know how to align with it somatically. There's one other thing I wanted to mention, and that I would love to hear from you, is that the way we store memory, when we're storing just regular everyday memory, right, and it's not too stressful, we actually access the hippocampus part of the brain. And the hippocampus does many things, but one of the things it specializes in is giving us episodic memory. So you can tell, like right now, I can tell I'm talking to you in present time. It's now. Right? I can remember, oh, I had whatever for breakfast, that's behind me, right? And then later I have a lunch appointment so that, you know, I can tell past, present, future very, very simply, very easily. I'm not confused about that. I also know that I'm sitting at my house, in my office. I know where I am. So it's also about location. I know where I am and I know where I am in time, but also in physical location. Now, when you hit a trauma memory, which is sort of a big arousal spike in the nervous system, or, you know, a lot of like electrical charge almost going through you, it can either be an over sympathetic response like anger, rage, feeling electric in your body, or it can be a over activated combination of sympathetic parasympathetic where you just shut down and you just kind of go into zombie land, right? You just disconnect. But the way trauma memory is stored, it goes to the anterior cingulate, and the anterior cingulate experiences everything as now. So when you hit a trauma memory, the gift that keeps on giving, you feel like you get transported back to age 5, age 10, age 2, age 16, age 35, whatever it is, and you feel like you're living it as if it's happening now. Forget the hippocampus. That doesn't come into play at all, usually, until you start processing and can regain your access to the hippocampus. But this anterior cingulate is saying, that's what a flashback is. Like, oh my God, I'm in this, I'm being assaulted again. I'm feeling the person attacking me, or I'm re-experiencing the car accident, or I'm re-experiencing the earthquake that I, you know, was exposed to. And you can't at those moments easily distinguish between what's like that I'm in my office right now. If I'm like, I did experience an earthquake and I had trouble with it for a while. You start to go to the earthquake memory. You forget you're in your office. You're reacting with that same threat response, that same intensity, that same terror, as if you were actually still in the earthquake. So that's what I mean about frozen in time. Partly it's the way the brain functions around high arousal memory states. And we're very state dependent. So if I import to the earthquake memory, for instance, or maybe I was abandoned by someone that really in a devastating way, or I had sexual abuse in my history, something like that. When you import that sort of that donut part where you're bringing in the support, you're bringing as a therapist or as a friend or as a partner, you're bringing in the resources that weren't there originally, then it starts to shift how we're processing memory. We start to regain access to episodic memory, past, present, future. We start to feel like we have a future. One of the symptoms when we're frozen in time is futurelessness. I'm sure you've talked to people that say, I feel like this horrible feeling is going to last forever. It's never going to go away. I'm going to feel this ocean of tears, this tsunami of sadness is never going to stop. And now we know it will, right? When we move things through. But very often the experience is, because I'm in the anterior cingulate, is this is forever. And that, just think about how devastating that is. But when we know how to work with it, we can move us through time and regain a sense of future.
Diane, one of the things that I think is really interesting here is that we have our connection to our adult resourceful self. And then we have the, in a way, the sort of the middle bit in the donut that we go into as we're starting to access and potentially work with healing that trauma. And one of the things that I think can happen, and I think there are certain psychotherapeutic approaches that perhaps in a way unintentionally encourage this, is that we become very identified with that place where there is no future. It feels like it's going to last forever. And it strikes me that it's not always very helpful to try and heal the place by complete absorption in there and losing that ground. It's like we try to heal the trauma from the place of the trauma without that connection to that, you know, to put it in other language, the adult self or the kind of resourceful self. So I'm interested in sort of spatially, in a way, like how we hold that place, but don't get lost in that place, but also we have to go to that place. I feel like that wasn't a particularly articulate question, but I think you know what I mean. So,
no, I totally get what you mean. This is part and parcel of the whole challenge, right? So I feel like somatic experiencing, there's many models out there now that include a somatic focus, but I've, you know, taught that for 35 years. So I have a deep knowledge there. So whichever one you're using is great. But when we understand how to track when a person's hitting overwhelm, if you think like there's a range of experience, a range of resiliency, right? And so we're trying to help people access their resiliency in the beginning. Like what helps you feel supported? How is it when you're sitting with me as we're talking about this? I'm going to be here. You're not alone this time. I'm with you. I'm happy to go wherever you need to go. That in itself is a huge resource, whether that's in I'm talking to my partner in a connection like a marriage or something, or if I'm talking to my therapist, right, or talking to a client. So you want to bring in things that sort of are relaxing to help that constriction that we get into when we're stuck in time and stuck in trauma to start to relax a little bit. And now the thing is, as it relaxes, it will open up more trauma, right? Because you're defending against it by the constriction. So as it releases, then you're going to get a little bit more possibly of maybe not even memory, but sensation or overwhelm or anxiety or panic or, you know, anger or whatever. And so then you have to make sure that you're touching into that, but you keep kind of regrouping around the resources somebody has access to. Maybe they love to be in nature, or they love to dance, or their heart just blasts open when they're with their kids and the kids are giggling or something, you know. So you're trying to find things that start to help the nervous system become more balanced. And then, and because we're designed to process high intensity states, this is a very strong orientation that I have, you know, is that you don't want, generally speaking, unless somebody's super duper resilient, you don't want to drive straight into the trauma, but we still have to access it. So you're just kind of like working the edge of it, or you're doing a little bit of it, and then you're reminding them of the resource, or you're reminding them that you're with them. You're reminding them that they're here in your office, or they're here in your living room. They're not in five when, you know, this terrible thing happened. And then, you know, in addition to that, really working with, especially if it's childhood states, you're kind of finding out what age this thing happened. You don't have to go into a lot of detail about it. You just kind of get a general idea of what was difficult. And then you sort of try to bring resources that they really needed then into their experience. It's an experiential kind of processing. So they can say, well, what difference? I mean, I know you didn't have a supportive person back then. I know that, because otherwise, if you don't acknowledge that, they're going to keep saying, yeah, but they weren't there. You can say, what is it like if you bring your really incredibly supportive spouse back into when you were five, you didn't know them then. But if you just bring their energy and that sense of support back to the time when you didn't have anything. You were just completely alone and abandoned and left to try to deal with something that was impossible to deal with. And then the body starts to, as it feels it deeply somatically, it starts to relax. It starts to feel a little less overwhelmed. And you can kind of go in and out, like alternating between what I would call just resource states or corrective emotional experiences. But you want to find relevant ones, you know, ones that kind of fit the scenario as much as you can. And people's nervous systems can do that. Yeah. And then when the nervous system gets more regulated, then you can do a little bit more. And as somebody has done maybe a lot of processing, or they have a pretty strong ability to go into trauma states and come back out and resource, you can do bigger pieces of the trauma and still stay regulated, because we grow in our capacity. So say your range of resiliency, I think Dan Siegel calls it window of tolerance. Your range of resiliency is like this. Well, let me see if I can. You want to grow it. You want that range of resiliency to keep getting bigger, so that even, okay, you're healing your history, but even, you know, stress doesn't stop with our history, right? When stress or something difficult happens in our current life, or, you know, because we're human beings, we bump into things all the time, then you have this resiliency that's already, your nervous system's been trained to allow for more stress and still stay regulated. So you mitigate against getting a recurring post-traumatic stress reaction. So even I mean, that's just one reason that it's good to go into your trauma history and learn how to work with it. But there's all sorts of other reasons, because it's not lurking behind the scenes ready to like sneak out into your marriage or sneak out into your work relationships or sneak out, you know, erupt in places that, you know, are really disturbing for you.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking some of the nuance in this is, I think sometimes people can feel that when they're doing a lot of their trauma healing work, that they start to feel they're becoming less resourceful in their life, not more resourceful. It's like they're spending more time in the wounded, painful place. And some of that time is that stuff shifting. And other times it feels like they're just sort of getting stuck in those triggers and in those places. And what I'm hearing in what you're saying is the importance of actually developing those resources and developing that sort of stable, reliable adult self that can hold that place.
And I want to emphasize to everyone listening too, that it's not just like, I mean, I could sit here and list, you know, I like, my favorite color is teal. You can tell, right?
Well, the way you say that between your top and the wall behind you.
You like that color? You like what you're wearing?
Right. But by the way, it was the cover of my last book, so I clearly like it as well, but there we are.
So, you know, you can, but it's so useful to not leave it just cognitive, like somebody just listing music, dance, nature, my dog, my kids, you know, you want to, okay, as you experience your kids giggling over there playing out in the yard and you're just like loving it, what happens in your body? How do you experience that? What do you notice? Your heart starts to open. Okay, great. What feeling starts to come up? Oh, I start to feel really delighted, you know, and I mean, the opposite could be true too. The kids are yelling and screaming. I'm feeling really annoyed, you know, but so you want to have it an embodied resource, not just a listed resource. Right. And then I mark them in my chart if I'm, you know, in a therapist role, I put like R+, and I have the ones that somebody's already embodied. So once it's embodied, I can be three sessions down the road and go, hey, let's go back to when this one person kept talking about her happy belly, her belly would relax, and she called it the happy belly. So I would just go, hey, remember, she's going through some arousal spike, another piece of the trauma. Hell, don't forget, you've got happy belly. And immediately she goes, oh yeah, thank you. I forgot about that. I feel happy belly. Okay. I've got that grounding in my belly, in my gut, you know, the gut brain's important. So you want to build your arsenal. That's that military term. You want to fulfill your toolkit with already embodied resources. And then you can use them all the way through the process of helping someone. But you want to stack them a bit in the beginning. You don't want to just go, okay, you had this horrible thing happen, let's talk about this horrible thing. You don't want to enter into trauma land with that, because your chances of getting the person flooded or completely disconnected and dissociated are really high when you understand how the physiology actually works, because the body's trying to protect them. It's like, nope, I'm not going there. We're not going to feel that terror again. Are you kidding? No way. So the body just changes it.
Yeah.
I do want to mention, this is an unusual thing. Well, I don't know if it's unusual exactly, but just to make a very strong point about how the body freezes things and remembers it and sometimes brings it up in an odd way. I had a client come to me, and she was beaten as a child a lot, and it was caned on the back of her legs, right? In a pretty brutal way. And when we were working with the resourcing and all of that, but as we were touched into the trauma, that wound actually surfaced. She showed me her legs, and the bruising came in the session. Wow. That's part of, I want people to understand that can happen, because it's a little surprising when it does. It doesn't happen very often. I mean, in my experience, I've had that happen maybe three times with people, and I've been doing this since 1987. So, you know, it's a long time, but that's even physiologically that the body can recreate the wound from the time it was frozen in the trauma of being beaten like that. That's kind of incredible. It's amazing. And it's actually called stigmata, but I don't like to use that word because people start to think about the, you know, sort of
got other meanings. Yeah.
Yeah. It has other meanings, but I don't mean that version of the meaning. I mean, when, like, I've had people spontaneously bleed. I mean, it's trauma when it's stored this is very, very uncommon, because I remember I said it three times since 87, but that's just to make the point that your body remembers, even if you don't remember. And sometimes, and that's why it's so important to, whether you have a specific memory or not, you can just track the arousal. You don't even have to have the memory. Like say, I feel like something's disturbing to me and this keeps happening in my marriage. I keep, whenever my partner does this, I have this really strong reaction. I don't know where it's coming from. It doesn't matter, even if you're still working on the Sherlock Holmes aspect of it, kind of solve the mystery. You don't even have to reclaim the actual memory, but you have to heal the body. So the nervous system's regulating, you're not having reactions to things that are causing, you know, pain in yourself and maybe somebody you're trying to be intimate with. Or just friends or kids or wherever you're having relationships. So that's another thing that I think is really important. Moving through time, maybe I should give a little bit of a clinical example.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, because I'm really dancing around being attachment informed and trauma informed in our knowledge of ourselves, but also working with other people. I had a young woman come to me. She's probably in her 30s or something. Lovely, lovely lady here in Boulder. And she says, I don't know what's going on. I am having panic attacks. I've never had panic attacks. I don't really have a trauma history. I'm fine. I came from a, you know, comfortable family. I'm good. But I don't know what to do. I have these panic attacks and they're happening more and more. And I said to her eventually, and I got a little more information, but I said, so what happened to you? Anything disturbing a year ago, a year and a half ago? The reason I say that is because very often we cope. And if we don't resolve what was disturbing us, it often shows up in a symptom a year to a year and a half later. And a lot of people aren't aware of that. So it's just nice to kind of know that. So I asked her, did anything, you know, difficult or stressful happen a year to a year and a half ago? And she goes, yeah. Oh, because I can't remember. And she goes, oh, yeah. She had twin boys. I took my twins with my sister and her kids, their cousins, to the reservoir to go swimming. And my one twin, I saw his head go under and it didn't come back up. I mean, you can imagine, right? So her sister jumped in the water because she was in the process of changing her clothes and taking her contacts out. So she just saw sort of a blur, but she couldn't get out of the tangle of her clothes to jump in the water herself. So her sister did everything right, got the kid, brought him up out of the surface. Kid, of course, is crying and screaming, brings him to the beach. She is a mom, does everything right. She holds the kid. She's, oh, honey, it's okay. You're okay. You're doing great. She regulates him. Kid goes back in the water, plays with his cousins and his brother, has a great time the whole day. And nobody did it for her. Right? Nobody did it for her. So I said, well, you did the right thing for your kid and he's fine, but what about you? Yeah. And she said, I said, so what, right now I want you to see, this is like a year ago, I want you to see your sons around the breakfast table and just see that they're both fine. Or you know, they're good. You know, they had their bacon and eggs this morning and just, you know, feel the last time you hugged them goodnight, just get a reality of her sons are okay. Especially the one that had the near drowning. And she did that. And then we did some things with her. And then I just had her, then I just focused on move through time because this was addresses the frozen in time piece. I said, when you see your son's head go under, it stopped there. Hmm. Her movie stopped there because she was like, of course, like absolutely terrified, right? So she never saw her son's head come up. So I said, okay, you see your son's head go under. We now know your sister rescued him. We now know you held him and you know, everything was fine, but you see your son's head go under. Now I want you just incrementally, we're going to go frame by frame to see the top of his head come out of the water, the little bit more of the head come out of the water, the eyes come up out of the water, the whole face and he's coughing coming out of the water. You see your sister swoop him up by his waist and she's holding him up. And I just took her frame by frame from that head under the water to the head coming up to the sister rescuing to coming out of the water to the beach and to her lap where she was. So I just filled in that piece of time. Well, of course that meant everything. Her threat response went, oh, phew. But she never had the, oh, phew. Because all in her memory, because of the frozen in time, she was in interior cingulate, even though she didn't even, sometimes you have flashbacks and you see that image. She wasn't seeing the image. She was just feeling the panic. So you can just have whatever manifests, right? But as soon as we just simply moved her through time and she got to remember holding him and, you know, seeing his head come up, she was fine. She never had a panic attack again. It was a one session deal. That's all she needed. She was fine. So now not every session's a one session deal, usually not.
But it shows the power, right?
Yeah.
Of when something's stuck, when it unsticks. And also what I think is really interesting what you're saying here is that the power of the innate capacity we have to heal, but we have to create the circumstance that then allows that to happen.
Right. That's why I think it's really important to understand what our psychology does, what our physiology does when it's managing high intensity states, right? And so, like, because I understood frozen in time, it came to me. If I didn't know that, I wouldn't have thought to do the intervention of just simply moving her incrementally through time. I needed to know that, right? So this is why I think these little tidbits are helpful to us, because you might not, you might just, I mean, she might just get on medication for panic attacks, which would be not a good idea. You know, I mean, it would probably work for a while, but it wouldn't be.
But it's managing the symptom, right? Rather than managing the issue. But also, as you're talking, Dan, what comes into my mind is, so I'm thinking about a group of people on the trauma healing journey who have got some substantial childhood trauma work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that I think it goes back a bit of building out my question from a bit earlier around, sometimes people can feel they become less resourceful, more resourceful. And I want to add to that, that I think particularly if we have those sort of achiever patterns, we can think the fastest way through my trauma is to make my whole life about healing my trauma. And every time we get a trigger, we're working with that and we're in that place. And it strikes me that in what you're saying here, that of course, if we don't have that grounding in now, and we don't, like, sometimes, like, particularly as I think, you know, some of my background of working people with complex chronic illnesses, that sometimes a lot of the scaffolding of someone's daily life starts to fall away. So they're not going to, for example, work, they're not necessarily taking care of children. And so their whole life can become their healing work. And in a way, what I observe sometimes is that when they do that, there's something very stabilizing and very grounding about the activities and busyness of daily life, which actually can make us more resourceful as we then meet those wounded, traumatized places. But I'm interested in your thoughts around that.
I think having the structure of work or the structure of, you know, being a mom or a dad is really helpful. Now, there are times that people get so overloaded, they have to abandon that for a short, I would say, usually, ideally, short period of time. But trauma that just pops up and floods us and can usurp our sense of functioning. Very often, this usurping happens when there's a major life change. If you have a strong trauma history and you haven't dealt with it, like if you move or get married or get divorced or get a new job or have a child or, you know, have a car accident, it will open the door. The impact of the stress of that will open the doors to unresolved. I've talked to attorneys about this, like why when they have a car accident do people have all their memories of sexual abuse come up, right? You know, it's so... it's part of the way we package and store memory that's high arousal. If you think about it, like the nervous system doesn't really care what the event was, and your nervous system's not going, okay, now I'm working on the arousal of the car accident, now I'm working on the arousal of the assault, now I'm working on the arousal of my divorce. Your nervous system just reads arousal. So if you think about like those, like Harrods department store, since we're talking to England, right?
Funnily enough, I was there on Sunday with the kids. not spending much money because we can't afford much in there, but took the kids for Christmas lights. So.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I love that store. I lived in England for a while.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I got a scholarship from college to spend a year in England. And I took, I was an art major as well as a business major and then eventually psychology. And I did photography. So I have all these great pictures, these unusual pictures from London. Someday we'll talk about that. But
yeah, we must. And before you continue your story, to contextualize, Harrods is an independent. Well, sorry, it's massive, but it's a very high end, massive department store in London, which is very famous. Yeah.
It's just an amazing experience. If you go to London, you got to go to Harrods. Yeah. But I'm just thinking of the levels, you know, like level one is, I don't know, I'm making this up now, you know, is jewelry. And level two is women's boots and, you know, women's clothing. And then level three is men's accessories and then furniture, whatever it is. If you think of your nervous system stores things by intensity. So the lower intensity might be on level one, then another intensity, another intensity, another intensity. Trauma intensity is going to be all stored in the same intensity. So it doesn't, you know, that's why sometimes you're working on sexual abuse with somebody and all of a sudden they start to have a pull to a car accident they had. And you're like, where did that come from? Because you're in the intensity, you're in the same intensity, like seeks like. So that's one of the reasons it's challenging. Also, that you want to, usually for most people, you want to keep them focused on one of those things, right? So that they don't get all of their high intensity stuff flooding in at once. But when that starts to happen, people will become over-identified with the trauma experience. And so it's really important that we keep going from high intensity to low intensity to middle intensity, high intensity. You're trying to help them have reestablish their range of experience and also find a way out of the high intensity. So they're not, their whole life doesn't become about that. Their whole identity doesn't become locked in about that. And it's easy for that to happen because if you are living with enough high intensity experiences, right, then you're just bouncing from the car accident to the sexual assault to the natural disaster to the, you know, you're just, you know, doing that. That's why it's so important to have embodied resources, to have a slow pace. The body, I can't remember the resource on this. I read it, but and so who knows if it's true, but it said that physiological processing time is almost 7 times longer than cognitive processing.
Wow, interesting.
So even if that's half true, right? I can't find the source on it. I remember reading it. Peter Levine goes, "Why did you find that? That's really good." I don't know. I read too much. So just if you think when you're starting to process to help the body come out of a trauma response, you need to give it lots of space and time. Now, very often as I'm helping somebody just really feel and move into physiological time, I might, depending on them, sometimes talking is distracting. And sometimes if they hear my voice, I might usually have their eyes closed. They feel that I'm there because sometimes if they close their eyes, I feel like they go into no man's land, right? No one's there. So depending on the person, I may slowly just go, yep, you're doing fine. Yep, just talk when you feel like talking, but you don't need to talk. No pressure to talk. I mean, I'll just have this kind of soothing, slow. You can tell I talk fast normally when I'm talking like this, but I go completely different rhythm when I'm in trauma time, you know, and in physiological time. So you want to make sure you give people enough time, because just even by talking as fast as you and I both talk, right, our normal pace would knock you out of physiological processing possibly.
Diane, what do you see as the difference between somebody in a place where they're emotionally processing trauma, like they're in the eye of it and that's where they need to be to let it move, and someone that's just triggered and reactivated? Like where's the place where healing's happening and where's the place where the pattern is just being re-triggered and actually not necessarily moving?
I had I'll give you a client example because I think those are really helpful. I had a gentleman, I really liked this guy, but he was the most angry person I had ever worked with. I mean, I used to work in this high rise, and when he walked in the front door, I'm not that sensitive, but I could feel it. I could feel his rage 8 floors above. I'm like, oh, David's here, you know? And he'd give me permission to use his name, and I wrote about him in my crash course book because it was about a really serious car accident. But he was so angry at this other driver, and I'm just as an aside, the accident was actually his fault, but we never really went there. But
you know, yeah, so it was David's fault, was it? Okay.
Yeah, it was with that, you know, okay, we're not going to the fact that he actually caused the accident, but oh well, whatever, you know. So because he went out in the wrong lane and the other car, and his car flipped, and you know, it was one of those really scary things. But he was so mad at this guy that every single session he would come in and it would just be another way to kill this guy. I'm gonna chop him up with a buzzsaw, and it would just be this rage, you know. And so about the third time I said, hey David, do you feel like as we go through these rage experiences that you're integrating anything? And I find that's really interesting. People can answer that question. And he thought about it and he goes, no. And I said, huh, that's interesting. I said, so I just do curiosity. I just become like, like I kind of like, what's that guy? Some detective that was always acting sort of dumb, you know. I forget his name. But so anyway,
it's a powerful tool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, so
particularly with someone that's angry, because they want someone to push against them.
You don't want it like coming at you, right? Yeah. So I said, that's really interesting, because I can see there's like this endless sense of rage. And of course, what you went through, I totally understand. I said, but you know, what I've noticed sometimes when we stay stuck on one emotion, whatever it is, there's something underneath it. That it's easier to feel the surface emotion, whether it's sadness or anger, whatever, but there's something underneath it that's we're not feeling that's sort of it's protecting us from, or it's the surface emotion. It's the what I would call the secondary emotion, not the primary emotion, right? It's the reactive emotion. And I said, since this is like so predominant for you. I'm just curious. I mean, when you tell me that you had this collision and then your car flipped and landed and, at, you know, the battery acids on your legs, and I mean, all this stuff happened, I would be terrified. I would be, oh my God, I would be so scared. He goes, oh no, I don't feel fear. And he was like the classic, I don't know if this is a good reference for the UK, but Marlboro Man, you know, the kind of, he was a rancher, and he raised organic beef.
Right, right. And, the cigarette ads. Yeah, I know the
one. Yeah, so he's definitely the all-American cowboy, and he hung out with other cowboys, and they would have brawls in the weekends, and you know they had that whole lifestyle, right? Drink and beat people up and beat them each other up. I don't know, it was just a rage fest, really. And so I said, then he goes, I don't do fear, you know, I'm not, you know, that, because that really didn't fit the Marlboro Man image, right? And I said, okay, good to know, you know. And I said, but just maybe something to consider. The next session, he comes in and he's really sheepish. He's like this. He's like, well, yeah, I realize I'm scared. You know? So as soon as we got to that, everything changed. He was allowed to feel the vulnerability. He was allowed to experience the fear, and he could also see that it moved through. Because remember, people have this feeling, if I go into that terror, it's never going to stop, right? But he found out it does change and does process, and you know, you get to the other side of it. He eventually ended up not hanging out with the cowboys anymore, and he became a deacon of his church. He became compassionate service oriented. He ended up getting married, had kids. I mean, I saw him at a festival because he was marketing his organic meat, and he was like, "Oh, my life's completely different." And it's just the transformative power we have as human beings. And one way I like to think about this actually comes from an insight from Gurdjieff. And I can't remember the exact quote, so I'm just going to say what it meant to me. He said, the best time to do spiritual work is when the world is in great turmoil. And I'm like, okay, like now, right? I thought, what does he mean by that? And what I took it to mean was the same energy. If you think of like compression, you know, like in a spring, like a really tight spring, the same energy that's pushing for constriction and for high arousal states and traumatic reactions and trauma identity and all that is that's pushing into this constriction. That same energy, if you learn to tap into it and relax it just bit by bit by bit, you know, bit a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and it starts to get more flexible and eventually starts to expand, that same energy is what fuels the transformation. So all the energy, I think one of the useful things about trauma, which is going to be a really weird thing to say, is that when we learn how to align with it properly, it fuels this transformative process, this creative process, this sense of resiliency. And there's a hidden gift in trauma. Not that you want to go look for any more than you've already got. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, but when we learn to align, that's the whole, I don't want to say trick, but that's the whole challenge, is how do we align with that really intense, terrible, scary, angry, yucky, feel awful, disconnected space that's fueled by high intensity? But how do we take that intensity and gradually shift it so it's fueling this transformation, post-traumatic growth experience, which we all have I believe most of us, I think I can never say everything for everything, but there is this potential, I think, for all of us to move into this highly transformative process. When you think about people that have trauma histories, like Viktor Frankl, I mean, I don't know, lots of people, and they actually have gone through the transformative process, they never go back to normal. People go, I want to go back to normal. I said, you're never going to go back to normal, because they become so much bigger than who they were when they had the thing hit them, whatever it was. And then they, you know, and disconnect or stuck in rage or stuck in trauma identity. When that shifts, they become these giant people. I have this gentleman, I just saw him yesterday. He was born to a young teenage mother, and she had no idea what to do. So she basically put him in like a Catholic foster care kind of thing, which was a really bad experience for him. He felt suicidal. It was really a strong experience for him. But now he's done so much transformative work. He's just as beautiful. He was always a beautiful human being, but he's really experiencing the beauty of his human beingness. He's now consulting social workers on foster care for kids, like what kids experience in that situation. He now has a great relationship with his wife. He's got a really close with his daughter, and all of that was usurped by the trauma till a couple, you know, I've been seeing him for a really long time, but you know, maybe if you go back 5 years, he was so stuck in the trauma focus that he didn't have a sense of himself. He was really just kind of enduring his marriage. I mean, his wife hung in there, thank goodness. But, you know, now they have this really clearly, truly intimate, connected relationship. So he's healed his attachment injury, which happened from being abandoned, and then also the trauma of that experience.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I think people often have no idea what they're truly capable of. And particularly when all those, that trauma is tying up our resources, like when we free that up, it's mm-hmm. like suddenly our real capacity gets unlocked. There's someone that's watching this, Diane, that is looking for the next step. And maybe they've been going into those places, getting a bit overwhelmed, getting stuck, or trying to develop that more resourceful place. You mentioned some things earlier that I think were helpful, but maybe a couple of practical steps before we come to how people can find out more about you and your work.
Okay. Well, I, you know, I'm a therapist, so I'm going to be biased in that direction. But I really think having somebody that's attachment informed and trauma informed to go with you on the journey is huge. Because, you know, just if you go to dentist for dental work, cardiologist for your heart problems, I think having somebody that can be there, really, really be present and hold whatever arises in our experience, even if it's really difficult or something we're ashamed about, or, you know, we can really talk freely and openly with, I think that's a huge gift. And on the other side, being a therapist or being that person that's in that spot, I feel it's a huge privilege to go on that journey with someone. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, because I'm actually holding the knowing that they're going to come out the other side. I'm holding the knowing that there's some, I don't know how it's going to happen, but I know it's going to happen, that they're going to move through this transformative process and just find out parts of themselves that astonish them, you know? So I know that having been through this journey with so many people, I know that's going to happen if they hang in there. And, but they don't know that. And they're not going to, I don't say that in the beginning because it's not going to make any sense to them. They're going to be like, you don't understand me, right? You don't get it that this I'm in locked in this place. So I start wherever somebody is. And then I just keep, you know, going through the window, through the front door, down the chimney, up through the basement, anywhere I can do it to find resources they relate to. And sometimes that takes a while. Somebody's really locked in and they're in that interior cingulate and they're in the traumas happening now and it never really stopped. It takes a while. I had this one person, I remember this so distinctly. I was in a live training, 3D, right? Live training. And she was one of the students in the training, I think a therapist, and she was locked in the threat response. She felt everybody in the room was unsafe. I mean, kind of like a paranoia feeling what you have when you're in a threat response, you know, that the world's not safe. Her body wasn't safe. She didn't want to go to her body because, you know, it's terrifying in there. It's electric. She's going to electrocute in her own body from the over arousal. So we started working. We started working with this, and I just say, you know, well, don't look at people, just look out the window or look wherever your eyes want to go. I mean, if it dislikes a certain color somebody's wearing, just focus on the color to forget the person's face, you know, and just look wherever, you know, just doing whatever I could to get her to orient a little bit. Cause when you're in threat, you collapse your visual field because, you know, if you think about it, if there's a snake in the room, you want to be like looking at the snake to see where you want to go and get the other way. Right. So your visual field narrows. So I was just trying to work with just that, you know, expanding your visual field a little bit. Oh, look at the ceiling, you know, go wherever your eyes want to go, you know, it's fine. And we started to help her relax. And then we went through other things, but eventually she actually stood up and she said, I feel completely different. And she's looking around and she goes, all these people look so nice and they're smiling and they look so friendly. And I feel they're here to support me. She goes, she's almost like, I don't know what happened. It's like she moved to a different planet. And I said, oh yeah, well, you were processing. We had all those other people, those bad people. We brought new people in because for her, they were brand new people. They weren't the same people, you know? And it was just a matter of like 10 minutes because I just was doing a little demonstration on how this works. And, You literally, that's what, it, I mean, I think it's helpful for people to know when you're stuck in a trauma response, you're living in a particular perception of reality that's very strong, feels extremely real, probably was started by something real or related to something real, or maybe it could be a perceived thing, right? That didn't actually happen, but you know, maybe it could be that you saw it on TV or something. But when you shift physiologically, psychologically, and that threat response calms down, your whole life, how you see relationship, how you see yourself, how you see the world, everything changes. And it can happen like that relatively quickly when somebody understands, who's with you, that can take you through and get you to complete the threat response and move out of it to experience yourself as a resilient, more open, vulnerable, connected, you know, being able to have intimacy with your partner, like the gentleman I was talking about. I believe there's a very strong marriage between attachment and trauma. I know we've talked about this a lot, but I think being informed in both of those bodies of knowledge, and especially including the body along with everything else that you know, because the body awareness can go with any other model, you know, can integrate with any model. I think is just invaluable, and I think very efficient. And what I love about it, it mitigates suffering. I mean, we're all committed to reducing suffering. For me, these are the ingredients that really help, in my experience clinically, but also personally, to reduce unnecessary suffering. And let's go for that, right?
Sounds good. Diane, if people would like to find out more about you and your work, what's the best place to go, and what is some of what they can find?
Okay. We have a website called traumasolutions.com. If you forget that, it also funnels into it if you just use my name, Diane Poole with an E, Heller.com, my English background. I was a Poole. English background. And so on that website, you'll see all sorts of different offerings, but we also have a free attachment quiz that you can take anytime you want. Just gives you kind of a point of exploration and some more information about attachment styles. It's free. You can take it as many times as you want. You can have your clients take it, your spouse take it, your kids, whoever you want to take it can take it. But when you take it, I always tell people, take it from the vantage point of one relationship at a time. Like, don't be thinking about mom and then thinking about dad or your partner, you know, in the mix. It won't give you really as accurate results. Think of one relationship at a time and then take it again if you want to take it about somebody else. And then you want to take it kind of thinking about your behavior or your reactions on not your best day. Maybe you're a little sick or a little tired. That'll show you a little bit more your default position in terms of attachment injury a little bit more accurately. So those are two things about that. And then also on there, we have in January, we're starting an attachment mastery program, which really talks, you know, goes into the origins of how attachment injury sets up. We also have, you know, different programs that throughout the year on topics related to attachment. Like, first one would be like how that original relational imprint gets set up in whatever happened in childhood. Sometimes, often it's parenting styles, but it can also be you were born into extreme poverty or racism or war zone, you know, and that's going to impact how you feel about being open and connected, right? So, you know, we want to be looking at all of that as realistically as possible. And then we're looking at the neurobiology of relationships later on. And we're also looking at the most challenging attachment pattern is disorganized, because it's really a combination of trauma and how we react to that relationally. So we're doing that in the fall. It's called Healing Dual Wounds, the attachment wound and the trauma wound. And we just did that course and people really loved it. And so it's just a way to, how do you navigate through the really complicated, complex PTSD challenges that so many of us face personally, or if we're in our coaching practice or our therapy practice, or just our partnerships with, you know, whoever we are connected to deeply. So we're trying to make this very practical. I'm super strong on interventions and exercises and ways to access resources. So it's very, very practical. And we just try to fill your toolbox with as many tools as we can possibly have you be aware of. And then you can pick the ones that you think work the best for you, right? Or work the best for a particular client. But you have a lot of choices, which I like.
That's awesome. Diane, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Great to see you, Alex. Take care and enjoy Harrods.